Okay, everyone, so welcome back again. So now we can continue this exciting suttas of the Buddha and see where it gets us. Today, or rather this afternoon, I'm going to have a look at this dependent arising in brief, just to get an overview of what it's about, and then we can go through it in detail over the next 3 or 4 days or something, and see where that gets us. So the first sutta I'm going to have a look at, just to give a brief background to dependent origination again, is called the Singsapa Grove Sutta. It's a very famous simile that I'm sure you all heard about before. I just want to use this just to how we should approach dependent origination, also other aspects of the Dhamma. I use this as a kind of framework to start out with. Okay, so I'll just read this and I'll make a few comments on the sutta as I go along here. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Kosambi in the Singsapa Grove. Then the Blessed One took up a few Singsapa leaves in his hand and addressed the monks thus, "What do you think, bhikkhus? Which is more numerous, the few leaves that I have taken up in my hand or those in the grove overhead?" "Venerable sir, the leaves that the Blessed One has taken up in his hand are few, but those in the grove overhead are numerous." "So too, bhikkhus, the things that I have directly known but have not taught you are numerous, while the things I have taught you are few. And why, bhikkhus, have I not taught those many things? Because they are unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life, that do not lead to revulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to nibbana. Therefore, I have not taught them." So I think this is an important point that the Buddha is making here. The point is that his understanding of things, his understanding of the world, his understanding of whatever matters is quite large. He has a lot of knowledge, if you like, a lot of insight. The word he uses here is things I have directly known. The word is abhinya, and abhinya really refers to direct insight or understanding of things. One translation of that word would be insight, and I know somebody who actually uses that translation for abhinya. So all the things I know a lot of things, but I only teach a few of those things. Why doesn't he teach all of those other things? Because they're not really directly related to the brahmacharya, to the monastic life, to any life which has to do with Buddhist practice. And this is an important point, because what are these things, right? It's important to kind of reflect a little bit. What are these things that the Buddha doesn't teach? Well, if he has realized something through abhinya, if something is true about the world or whatever, then we can take it that these things that he has realized are like philosophical points, right? Things that are true about the nature of reality, the nature of the world, but don't actually have any direct impact on how we're supposed to do our practice. Remember that even science used to be called natural philosophy. If you go back 100 years or so, something in English, science was natural philosophy. So science is also included in that. It's a very broad idea of what philosophy is. It's very broad. It's basically about understanding and especially understanding the world in a broader sense. I remember a while ago, I was reading this sutta out to somebody, I can't remember where it was anymore. And I said to them, wouldn't it be exciting to know all those things that the Buddha knew about? Wouldn't that be really, really, really cool to know that? They said, yes, that would be great. I would like to know all those things that the Buddha knew, but that he didn't teach. Then I said, well, that's exactly the point, right? The point is that it is interesting. We want to know about science. We want to know about the workings of technology. We want to philosophize sometimes. Is the, you know, one of the things that you philosophize about, is the world, is it just mind-made? Is there any physical reality to the world? These kind of things, which are later philosophical discussions that they actually had in Buddhism, right? We know they had these ideas were discussed a lot. And if you look at the history of Buddhism in India, you see the various types of school of Buddhism. A lot of philosophical speculation was done in those schools. And I think a lot of the decline of Buddhism in India, I mean, yes, the Muslim invaders did their part, but that wasn't the main reason why Buddhism disappeared. It disappeared mainly because of the corruption within Buddhism itself. The decline was already very strong before the Muslims came, and then the Muslims kind of killed it off, were kind of the final straw that kind of eliminated altogether. But all the philosophizing, right, all the massive universities they had, and Nalanda University with tens of thousands of students and thousands of teachers. For those of you who have been to India, you would see some of the remains, only a small fraction that you can see today of what it was like originally. Enormous remains. All of that, I think, was precisely because this very simple teaching, they didn't take this simple teaching to heart. They forgot about some of the most basic teachings of the Buddha. They started philosophizing, thinking about things, arguing with each other, one person against another one. Right? When you entered that university, you had to answer three questions from somebody who was examining you. And a lot of the curriculum was apparently debating and that sort of thing. And of course, it doesn't really, it doesn't actually go anywhere as far as practice is concerned. So we also need to be careful with this, because it's very easy to get into endless philosophical discussions about the Dhamma, and dependent origination is one of those areas where people like to do this. So I'm just setting this up now to say I don't really want to philosophize too much. I want to focus on those aspects that actually are useful, that bring you forward, that actually have an effect on how we do our practice. It also, one of the things that dependent arising does, it presents the world view of the Buddha, how he saw the world. I think this is an important aspect, perhaps a little bit philosophical, but I think that is so important that it needs to be covered as well. The idea of the middle way, the dependent origination being the middle way. And of course, another thing which I feel is mostly a lot of philosophical discussion and mostly philosophy. From my point of view, the Abhidhamma is also a little bit like that. It tends to be philosophizing. If you read the Abhidhamma, you have the Dhamma Sangani, the enumeration of the Dhammas, right? It lists all the Dhammas. You have the Patana, which kind of puts them together, shows the relationship between them. There's an enormous, Patana is an enormous, enormous work if you fill it out completely. Somebody calculated that if you took out all the ellipsis points, all the dot, 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 right, and filled in completely the Patana, the book would be, almost 1,000 kilometers long, right? That's how big it would be here, because it is just such an incredible work, basically, the Patana. So to me, again, I feel one of the problems with the Abhidhamma is perhaps, it's just my personal position, it's too much philosophizing, basically, here. Anyway. I don't really, so that's just the way I tend to look at that. So these things, what is the problem with these things? They are unbeneficial, right? In other words, this is anatta sanghito, right? Anatta sanghito, they don't actually go towards any goal, any purpose. Atta means purpose, aim, goal. We're not moving towards nibbana anymore. Irrelevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life, adi brahmacharyaka. So not having to do with the essence of what the spiritual life really is about. Not leading to revulsion, nibbida, this word in the suttas, which I think is sometimes translated as disenchantment. But I think translating it more strongly brings out the flavor of what this word is about. Maybe repulsion would work, right? The idea that you're turning away from something quite forcefully because you see the dukkha. You say, oh no, I can't take it anymore. You turn away. It's like you are repelled by it. Nibbida, dispassion, viraga, cessation, nirodha, peace, upasama, this profound peace. Here we get to these beautiful things on the path. Direct knowledge, abhinya, enlightenment, sambodha, and nibbana, of course, at the very end. All of those things you are not getting there through speculation. These days I think it is nice to translate all the words, even a word like nibbana I prefer to translate. Sometimes when you leave these words untranslated, it means that people don't really have any feeling for what it means. in, you know, at the time of the Buddha, Nibbana would have a very clear meaning. It would mean something which is extinguished or extinct even. So I like to translate Nibbana these days as something like extinguishment, something which is extinguished, like a flame going out. You know the simile from the suttas, right? And when you do that, you give it a meaning in the same way that this had a meaning for people in ancient India when they were reading these things. Otherwise, Nibbana is just like, doesn't have any meaning. You can put anything you want into that word and think it means almost anything here. So, this is the reason I have not taught these things. So what has the Buddha taught? And what bhikkhus have I taught? I have taught this is suffering. I have taught this is the origin of suffering. I have taught this is the cessation of suffering. I have taught this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And why, bhikkhus, have I taught this? Because it is beneficial, relevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life, and leads to revulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to insight, to awakening, and to extinguishment. Therefore, I have taught this. Therefore, bhikkhus, an exertion should be made to understand that this is suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the origin of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the cessation of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So that is what the Buddha has taught. Because it takes you to the goal. It leads you somewhere. And of course, in a sense, the Four Noble Truths that you have, mentioned here in brief, of course, that is like a cover for all the teachings of the Buddha, right? Everything that he has said, this is like a summary or a container for all of those teachings. As you can see in the Mahahatipadopama Sutta, the greatest discourse on the elephant's footprint, the Venerable Sariputta says this is the kind of the footprint and all other teachings, all of the smaller footprints fit into this big one of the big elephant. In the same way, all teachings of the Buddha fit into the container of the Four Noble Truths. So basically, that is what he's saying there. And of course, it's also very interesting from our point of view, because now that we are going to look at dependent origination, this is also the start point of dependent origination. It starts with the idea of right view, right? It starts with the idea of avidya. And avidya, of course, is precisely the lack of understanding of the Four Noble Truths. So this is going to be a good setup for that as well here. Okay, so there you are, the very nice little Singsapagrava Sutta. And now let us move on to dependent origination itself. Okay, so here we go. This is dependent origination. So, I'll just start off by perhaps reading a little bit, and then we can talk about it. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," those bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, I will teach you dependent origination, Paticca Samuppada. Listen to that and attend closely, I will speak." "Yes, Venerable Sir," those bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this. And what, bhikkhus, is dependent origination? With ignorance as condition, there are volitional formations, or there are willed activities. With willed activities as condition, there is consciousness. With consciousness as condition, there is name and form. With name and form as condition, there is the six sense bases. With the six sense bases as condition, there is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. With feeling as condition, there is craving. With craving as condition, there is clinging. With clinging as condition, there is existence. With existence as condition, there is birth. With birth as condition, there is old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. This, bhikkhus, is called dependent origination. Okay, so I'm sure you all know this teaching already. It's kind of one of those things that you, and I'm in a Buddhist country, you would learn about, almost everyone would learn about it. But it is a profound teaching. It has a lot of implications. I'm not going to pretend that I know all the implications of dependent origination. All I can really do is to draw out a few that I feel are important. Remember what Venerable Ananda said in the Mahanidana Sutta, which is one of the main suttas on dependent origination. He says to the Buddha, "Oh, dependent origination, it is so profound, so deep, but I can see it really clearly." And then the Buddha says, rebukes him, says, "Do not say so, Anna, do not say so. This dependent origination really is very deep." So when you see that, you realize you have to be a bit humble about thinking that you have understood this to the core. Because even Venerable Ananda, who presumably was a Seka at that time, he presumably was an Arya, even he, you know, was having difficulties comprehending the full range of dependent origination. And which is actually interesting. It means that there is a lot to be gained, perhaps, from contemplating this particular teaching sometimes. So the first thing we want to do is to have an overview of what is going on here, a kind of bird's eye view of dependent origination. And of course, the first thing that you see when you look at this formula is that every step is a condition for the one that follows. Paticca, right? Avijja paticca sankhara. So each one is a condition for the one that follows. Now, in what sense is it a condition? And you can see this when you look at the general formula for dependent arising, imasming sati idang hoti, when this is, that is, right? So there is a relationship of what we can call sufficiency from one condition to the next one. One condition exists, then the one which comes after it must arise. And this is sometimes called sufficient conditionality. It's a very nice word to use, sufficient conditionality, because it shows you that one cause is sufficient for the effect that follows. That's what imasming sati idang hoti, I think, is basically saying. When one thing exists, what comes after it has to follow as a consequence. One is a sufficient condition for the other one. So the point here with this dependent origination is that every link is a sufficient condition for the link that comes afterwards. And because it is a sufficient condition, it means that when the first condition is in place, the second one has to arise. When the second one arises, the third one has to arise. And so it goes all the way to the end, to dukkha at the end of dependent origination. So once you have avijja, you have no choice. You have to suffer, right? There's no such thing as ignorance is bliss, right? This is kind of some of this, you have to be very careful with these kind of modern sayings, right? Oh, ignorance is bliss, that kind of stuff, because often it is some kind of shallow saying which has nothing to do with reality. In Buddhism, ignorance is suffering. So you can go out and say, oh, ignorance is suffering, ignorance is suffering, and then people will wonder wonder what's going on. But it's the exact opposite of what we think it is sometimes, right? We think ignorance is bliss. No, it's the exact opposite as a matter of fact. So once you have ignorance, then dukkha follows as an absolute consequence. There is no way out of that. But what is interesting, in the next paragraph, we talk about the cessation order of dependent origination, right? When you eliminate avidya, what happens then? Then the opposite happens. From the elimination of avijja, sankhara is eliminated. And again, it's exactly the same thing. Each step of the way, from eliminating one, the one afterwards is eliminated. And this shows you a different kind of conditionality, which also is happening within dependent origination. And this conditionality is one of necessity, necessary conditionality. In other words, if avijja isn't there, sankhara cannot happen. Sankhara depends on avijja for its existence. Without it, it's impossible for it to be there. Avijja is a necessary condition for sankhara. Sankhara is a necessary condition for vijnana, consciousness. Vijnana is a necessary condition for nama-rupa. It's a whole sequence of necessity. And what that means, of course, this is the solution, the wonderful solution to the whole problem. If you take away avijja, the whole sequence ceases as a consequence. That is the importance of this idea of necessary conditions. So in the forward arising of dependent origination, you have the conditionality called sufficiency. In the cessation mode of dependent origination, you see the idea of necessity instead. So I think you all know this already. It's just these are just a way of labeling it and showing how this works in a way which makes sense also in English, if you like. Yeah. So this is what it is. It shows us basically why suffering exists in the world, or why there is suffering, or why there is not suffering is the alternative. And when you have a sequence of that with 12 links, each one leading to the next one, and again, it's the same thing I was talking about this morning here, that the importance here is, of course, then the first link and the last link are the most important ones. Because the ones in the between, they just transmit like information from the first one to the last one here. So if you focus on those just for a second, the first and especially the last link of dependent arising here, the last link shows us then the purpose of all this, right? It shows us why the Buddha has talked about this. The last link is dukkha. So what this shows us is that the Buddha is here explaining the causality, why dukkha arises in the world. This is the main purpose of dependent arising. Why is the dukkha? This is what it shows us. And of course, that is why it is so useful, right? Everybody wants to know why there is dukkha, because if you know why there is dukkha, you also know why there is a lack of sukha. If you know why there is suffering, you know why there is a lack of happiness. So it is, of course, basically this dependent origination is basically the thing, the answer to that question that everybody has in their life. How can we move towards more happiness? How can we move away from suffering? It is the answer to the question, really, of the meaning of life itself. That is why it is of such fundamental importance. If you have full understanding of dukkha, full understanding of sukha, why it arises, the causality behind it, you have the full answer to the meaning of life itself. So, and of course, when it says here the whole mass of suffering at the end, it means this eternal wandering around in samsara, right? The samsaric existence, going round and round, meaningless wandering on without any point, nowhere that we're heading to, just more suffering upon suffering. Yeah? That is why the whole mass of suffering is mentioned here at the end. And I will talk a little bit more about this later on. So this is, now we know the purpose of this. And of course, then we have the other end of dependent origination, which is avijja. This is then the cause. This is the reason why they're suffering. And again, very useful, right? Because this is the root reason. We know what we have to do to overcome suffering in life. We have to get rid of avijja, basically. And we have to give rise to vijja, the opposite, instead. And of course, if you think about it, you know that is, of course, the whole purpose of the Noble Eightfold Path, of the gradual training. It's all about giving rise to vijja, right? You have the gradual training always ends in the te vijja, recollection of past life, understanding the laws of karma, or understanding how people pass on according to their actions, to be precise. And finally, the destruction of the asavas, the deep-rooted defilements of the mind. This is that real te avijja. So by giving rise to that, you are eliminating avijja, so we know what we have to do. And this is how the gradual training connects directly into the noble to dependent arising here, right there. So again, it's this kind of jigsaw puzzle where everything belongs together here. So that is just an overview of dependent origination. It gives you an idea of why the Buddha taught these things. You might ask the question perhaps at this point, well, but doesn't the second noble truth, doesn't that say that tanha is the cause of suffering? Why does dependent origination say ignorance is the cause of suffering? Which one is right? Maybe did the Buddha contradict himself? Or did somebody else maybe put these things sneakily into the canon because they weren't happy with tanha? Tanha wasn't good enough, they wanted something more. And the answer is that there is, with everything, there is many ways of regarding the Dhamma. We should be very, very slow to kind of assume that one thing is wrong, another is right. Just different angles of seeing the same thing. And of course, in here, you see tanha, craving is right there in the middle. And of course, tanha also is a condition for birth or for suffering itself. And in fact, when you read certain suttas like the well-known Bhava Sutta of the Anguttara Nikaya 3, it says that craving is the sap that allows consciousness to grow in a certain existence. So in that sense, craving is the cause, right? Because it allows consciousness to grow. Without craving, consciousness cannot grow anywhere. It means it comes to an end instead. So in one sense, craving is very much the cause of suffering in that sense. It drives the round of existence, drives our movement from life to life, right? Without craving, that cannot happen. But the problem with craving is that you cannot really just stop it. You can't just say, craving, stop, right? Or you can't do anything to eliminate craving. What you can do is you can reduce craving by yonisomanasikara, by sense restraint, indriya sangvara sila, all of these things. But practice in the right way, it can kind of die down, right? Until one day you get into samadhi, and then you come out of samadhi, and you think, yeah, this is it. And if you're not the Buddhist, you think, wow, this is enlightenment, right? I've attained this wonderful, amazing unity with the universe. Whoa, wow, how wonderful. And then one day, craving comes back again, This is a problem, right? It is always there in the background. You cannot permanently eliminate craving just by restraining the senses and these kind of things. And this is why going back to the root of avidya is so important. Sometimes people say that the dependent arising can kind of be broken between avidya and tanha. But I think that is true to some extent, but it's not the full truth. The full truth is that dependent arising can only really be eliminated at the very beginning, at avidya. That is where you have to eliminate it. That is the kind of root problem of this whole thing. And that is why the Buddha brings it back all the way to avidya instead. Avidya, yes, that we can do something about. We give rise to vidya instead through samadhi, through insight and these things. So, and that is also why sometimes when you read the suttas, you see that the Buddha sometimes puts dependent arising instead of tanha being the cause of dukkha. Sometimes dependent arising is there in the second noble truth instead, in the same way here. Okay, so that is the reason. So dependent origination is really the fullest explanation of this, right? And this is kind of the idea. In a sense, you can say that when the Buddha says that tanha is the cause of suffering, you could say that that is a very short explanation of dependent origination. It's like the shortest one. But this is kind of the standard way that it is explained. So what else is this formula about? That's really enough, isn't it? It shows that ignorance is the root cause of suffering. That's already pretty profound and very important, obviously. But does it show anything else? And the answer is yes. It probably shows a large number of things. And one of the things that it shows is also how this process happens without any abiding self, without any I, without any permanent entity, any essence inside of us. And this is one of the most important things that dependent origination shows. And that is perhaps the most profound aspect itself of dependent origination, that it shows how just a large links of causes and effects eventually gives rise to suffering without any self inside, without any kind of solid thing inside, which is at the core of this whole process. This is very important, right? And this is what you find specifically in the famous Kacchana Gotta Sutta in the Nidana Sanyutta. It's basically about that. And I will go have a look at that in detail later on. The vast majority of people, if you ask them, oh, you know, rebirth, they will say straight away, oh, there must be a self there, because otherwise, how can it move from one life to another one? There must be some entity that kind of traverses through this, right? And people will argue this, and it feels like that, perhaps for us as well, right? For most people, that's what it feels like. But this is part of the profundity of the Buddha's teaching. It's precisely that he saw that is necessary here. This process happens all by itself without that thing carrying on through from one end to the other one here. So that is another very important aspect of dependent origination, and that is one reason why it is called the middle way. It is the middle way between annihilationism and eternalism. And I would show you later on why that is the case and how it is the middle way between those two. Okay, so that is what it does. What else does dependent origination show? There are more things, but I'm not sure if anything comes to the mind right now. What else is in there? Okay, so maybe let's just continue from there. And having looked at kind of the overview of what dependent origination is about, now I want to look at each of the factors and just to very briefly see what they are and how they work and how they how the conditional relationship works from one factor to the next one. This is just going to be in brief. I think it's perhaps important to say these things a few times because they tend to be quite interesting but also quite profound. First of all, it has with ignorance as condition, there is these willed activities. I prefer willed activities for sankhara rather than volitional formations. Willed activities is something that I feel I can understand. Volitional formations, I feel, verges on the incomprehensible for me at least. So I try to kind of, this is one of the things that I feel is so important with the suttas, is to give them in a language that people can understand properly. Because the Buddha, I have no doubt that the Buddha would have taught the suttas in a way that people could understand, right? You read this, a lot of ordinary people became monastics. A lot of ordinary people were lay disciples. And unless he taught in a way people could straight away understand, he would have been wasting his time. It wasn't some highfalutin teaching. It was something fairly down to earth that people could grasp straight away. And I think one of the aims of translation would be to replicate that you read it and you can understand it pretty much straight away. Of course, there are depths, there are implications to the suttas, which are important not to miss out as well, but there should be also some degree of immediate understanding there. Okay, so ignorance as condition, there are these willed activities. What does that mean? Why are there willed activities as a consequence of ignorance? And the main reason for that is because one of the main things that we are ignorant about is the happiness and suffering in the world, right? We don't really understand where true happiness lies. We don't understand where suffering lies. And that's why the Buddha has to start out with talking about the first noble truth, the noble truth of dukkha, because he has to tell us, actually, there is a problem here. You don't even see this problem. You don't know. You think this is happiness, but actually it is suffering here. As it says in one of the famous verses somewhere, it says, I can't remember exactly where that verse is now, perhaps in the Dhammapada, I'm not sure, but it says that what the Aryas in the world think is happiness, the Pratujanas think is suffering here, and what the Pratujanas think is happiness, the Aryas, the noble ones, think is suffering here. So it's almost like complete reversal, right? Basically, we don't know. No idea what's going on. Whoa, this is... And this is problematic, because what that means, because you think you know where suffering lies, or suffering lies in kind of having a relationship, or suffering relies in continuing existence into the future, suffering lies in indulging in all these pleasures of the world, right? Happiness lies there, rather. And because you think you know where happiness is, you go out and pursue the happiness. And that pursuit of that happiness, this is the sankhara. You go after the happinesses in the world. You try to acquire those things, right? Of course, after a while, you start to think, well, maybe there's something not quite right about this. But it takes a while to change the course of the mind, because the mind is like this freight train, this heavily loaded freight train, has a massive momentum, and it's very hard to change course. The habits are so strong here. So, you start to understand this. And you start to see that all these activities in life, all this comes from this misunderstanding. There's more to it than that, and I will explain this later on, but this is one of the basic misunderstandings. And it drives our craving, right? If happiness lies over there, I have to go and get it. So driven by craving, craving for existence, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for whatever, really. So then you have the sankharas. You start acting by body, speech, and mind to get those things. You go out into the world pursuing that happiness for yourself, not knowing that actually you're just prolonging the suffering, prolonging your stay in samsara, and really creating problems for yourself. Right? So then you start doing all these things. Now, in the course of doing all these activities, you do bad actions and you do good actions. That's what happens, right? If you pursue things in the world, sometimes somebody gets in your way, right? So you become a bit ruthless and you push them to one side. You know, you're kind of fighting over the same boyfriend or girlfriend, or you're fighting over the same job, or you're all these kind of things, right? The world is always like that. Sometimes somebody gets in the way. Well, you're not going to be, not always anyway, going to be kind to them. Sometimes you're going to be ruthless and harsh and all these kind of things. So in the pursuit of happiness in the world, we make a mix of good karma and bad karma, depending on the situation, depending on whether we feel whatever the situation demands of us. And every time you do an act which is bad, what happens? You are dragging yourself down. You're dragging your consciousness down. This is one of the things I would recommend you to see inside of yourself. You do something which isn't kind to somebody else, you can actually often feel that your mind is being dragged down, being lowered in a certain sense. You feel bad about yourself, right? Or you do a kind act, you lift yourself up. You feel, yeah, I did something kind. And you feel good inside yourself. And you feel a sense of happiness about your own conduct. So all these sankharas, what they do is that they decide the level, if you like, of your consciousness, the quality of your consciousness, the degree of happiness and suffering in your consciousness. Do a lot of bad acts, you're dragging yourself down, right? You're kind of lowering the consciousness level, lowering the quality of your own mind. You do a lot of good things, you're lifting it up. And if you accumulate all of these actions, the good and the bad, you will find that it's kind of somewhere on this scale, that is where the level of the consciousness will be. It's fairly obvious when you think about it. And this level of consciousness, level is just a metaphor, right? It's not really a level. It's like a quality, a sense of well-being or whatever. That degree will depend on all your actions. So consciousness, the mind, is directly related to the volitional activities. You do acts of the will. It affects your consciousness straight away. And you can see that for yourself, that must be the case. Then, of course, so that is one aspect of this. The other aspect is that because of those volitional activities, you also have a certain direction in the mind, right? If you're interested in the world, if you're interested in sensuality or whatever it is, that is where your mind is directed. That is the aim, the atta of the mind, the purpose of the mind. And you can know that purpose, again, by looking at your mind, understanding your mind. What are the desires? What are the attachments that the mind tends to come back to, right? That you tend to think about? That is where your mind is aiming for. The mind is looking for solutions in that area. The mind is craving in that area. The mind wants to move forward, to acquire those cravings, or to make those cravings go away, basically. That is kind of a purpose of the mind. And you can see that by looking at your own attachments in life. Those attachments are always changing, right? You may start off in monastic life, still have a lot of sensuality. Hopefully after a while it decreases a little bit, and you have more interest in meditation instead. And you can see how the direction of the mind is changing. You're looking for solutions somewhere else. Craving is taking a different course, right? Your purpose, your aim in life is changing. Your aim is somewhere else. So sankharas do these two things. They aim your mind in a certain direction, and they give a quality to the consciousness. And then, of course, when you come, finally die, your consciousness already has a certain level, right? Then, of course, you continue on that level. That level that you have in this life is roughly the level that consciousness continues with when you then pass away into the next life. You have kind of created that level for yourself in this life through your sankharas, through the willed activities. So consciousness has a certain level. Now, when consciousness has a certain quality or level to it, then it will establish itself in whatever realm corresponds to that level. These are the vijnana tittis. You see that in the Mahanidana Sutta, the stations of consciousness, stations itself at a certain level, right? And that is equivalent then to the area of rebirth. And once you are reborn into that realm, the nama rupa will already have a certain limits set to it. The nama rupa are all the experiences we have, right? It is defined in the suttas here as basically the four other khandhas, plus a few more extra factors, but essentially it is the four other khandhas apart from consciousness. So once you are established in a certain realm, the limits of Namarupa are established. Namarupa has to exist within certain limits. If you are reborn as an animal, right, you can only experience certain happiness. You only can eat, if you're a kangaroo in Australia, you can only eat grass, right? And if you give the kangaroo a piece of chocolate cake, whoa, they are so happy. It's very funny. If we eat grass all day, chocolate cake, wow, it is so wonderful. Even just a bit of pizza, right? Kangaroos eating pizza, whatever. They are so, the eye is lighting up. Whoa, this is something different. So basically because they are trapped in Nama Rupa, which means grass, 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 grass. That's what they get. So depending on the level, your Nama Rupa is set within certain limits. If you're reborn in a meditation, in like a jhana realm, you have very limited scope for sannya and vedana. You feel certain feelings, and almost only those feelings, right? Same with sannya, etc. So the limits of Nama Rupa are set. When the limits of Nama Rupa are set, the limits of salayatana are also set. The salayatana, the six sense bases, will have certain qualities, right? In the immaterial realm, there will only be the mind. And in the ordinary human realm, there will be the six senses. And also the qualities of those senses will be limited according to that particular realm. And when the six sense bases are present, this is one of the important aspects of Nama Rupa. Sense bases are part of Nama Rupa. Then, of course, through those, we contact the world. Right? We experience the world through the six sense bases. Every moment of experience is a moment of contact. Your kind of the world is coming here. You know, you're experiencing the world. And then when we experience the world, of course, feeling arises together with that experience. Every moment of experience, every different experience has a feeling to it. And feeling is one of those crucial aspects of dependent arising, because feeling in many ways is the thing which is closest to us, right? Feeling is very close. Feeling matters the most because we want good feelings, not bad ones. So feeling becomes one of these crucial pivot points of dependent arising, which then decides the course of what we do afterwards. So from feeling, tanha must arise. It's very obvious, right? Very obvious why that is the case. Feel bad, tanha goes to avoid that. Feel good, tanha goes to have more of that. Tanha, craving, we go again out, pursuing good feelings in the world. We are back pretty much where we started, with avidya and sankhara. And part of that pursuit of things, part of that tanha that we have, is that we start taking hold of things, taking things up, grasping things in the world. Upadana, right? We become attached to things. You become the owner of things. You become the owner of all the of your house, of your car, of your views, right? Views are one of the important things that we are owners of. There's one nice sutta somewhere that says that lay people, they fight over sensual objects, but the samanas, they fight over views, right? So we own our views just in the same way that we own often the material things. So we take these things up, and I will show you later on how upadana actually encompasses all of these things. And we become owners of these things. And because we are owner of these things, these are the things we are concerned about. If you have a nice house, you have a car, you have all these things, if you have views about certain things, your mind is preoccupied about those things. It tends to go back to those things all the time. So you exist in a sense and have a mental existence that relates to what the things that you own in the world. Bhava, you exist in that way. And of course, once you exist in that way, you create kamma accordingly. This is the kamma bhava. And then when you have that kamma bhava, you can see how this reflects the first part I was talking about. When you have the kamma bhava, you then have the, this is the commentarial term, the upapatti bhava, which is basically, I understand, to be jati. Jati, yeah, you get reborn in a certain realm. And once you are reborn in a certain realm, you are stuffed, right? That was the big mistake. You got reborn. Okay, so now you're going to have to experience old age and dying, and the whole mass of suffering just keeps on continuing. Once you're reborn, there's nothing much more you can do about that. So that is dependent origination for you in brief, and how it works. And a very beautiful teaching. I think you can already see in there that there's so many practical aspects to that. If you look at it, you can actually see many of these factors alive, probably right now, right? In your existence, in your life at this moment, you can see these things in operation. So that is the idea of dependent arising in the forward mode. And now we can have maybe a brief look at it also in the reverse mode of dependent arising. So I'll read this out as well and quickly go through how that works as well. But with the remainderless fading away and cessation of avidya, ignorance, comes the cessation of willed activities. With the cessation of the willed activities comes the cessation of consciousness. With the cessation of consciousness is the cessation of name and form. With the cessation of name and form, the cessation of the six sense bases. With the cessation of the six sense bases, there is the cessation of contact. With the cessation of contact, there is the cessation of feeling. With the cessation of feeling, there is a cessation of craving. With a cessation of craving, there is a cessation of taking things up or grabbing hold of things, of attaching to things. With a cessation of attachment, there is a cessation of existence. With a cessation of existence, there is a cessation of birth. With a cessation of birth, there is a cessation of old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. Hooray! End of all suffering. Yeah. Great, right? So this shows you the ending of all of this, how the whole mass of suffering comes to an end. And of course, remember, the Buddha is always, he always understates himself a little bit. But the Buddha is one of the original understaters. When he says the end of the whole mass of suffering, of course, he means that in a very complete sense. Every tiny smudgeon of suffering has come to an end as a consequence. Again, so let's just quickly go through this. I think it's important to go through this a couple of times because there's a lot of information, so to speak, to digest. So the more often we go through it, maybe the more clear it will become, perhaps. So the fading away of avidya, cessation of avidya, what does that mean? It means that you understand that the places where you thought happiness were to be found in the world, right? In sensuality, in existence itself, right? You understand that actually it is the wrong place to look for happiness. You don't really want to exist anymore. You don't want to continue on in samsaric existence. You're not going to seek for happiness in sensual pleasures anymore. And once you understand that, once you see that there is no pleasure to be had there, in fact, pleasure is to be had precisely in the ending of existence, then you stop creating those activities. You stop looking into the future for some kind of happiness, and you just become happy in the present moment. You no longer create that future because there's no point in creating suffering, creating problems. So the sankharas, they die down. There's no more looking to the future. There's no more purpose, no more aiming in the future for happiness anymore. There's just this happiness, this will abiding in the present moment and being happy here and now, not looking anywhere else. So this is the power of turning things upside down. You stop projecting yourself into the future. And when you stop projecting yourself in this way into the future, it means you have stopped creating karma, right? In fact, you have made the karma which makes an end of all the other karma. And so the consciousness is no longer established anywhere in any particular level. Up to this point, consciousness is established depending on where your mind is pointing. Your mind may be pointing towards the jhana realms or towards the sensual realm or whatever, because that's what you're interested in. That's the purpose of your mind. The mind doesn't have that purpose anymore. That purpose has been entirely eliminated. Your mind isn't pointing towards any realm anymore. It doesn't want to go anywhere, right? Because it doesn't want to go anywhere, it means consciousness isn't established in any of these levels. It's got nothing to do with these particular levels. And also, the color of consciousness, instead of being the color of consciousness either being very bright or very dark, you have now made the kind of karma which is neither dark nor bright. It's like consciousness has gone beyond the whole idea of dark and bright karma to the neither dark and bright karma. And for that reason, it doesn't really have a coloring which matches with any particular future rebirth. So because the consciousness isn't pointing towards anything, yeah, when you die, it isn't going anywhere. It's not projecting itself into the future. Yeah. It's not kind of heading anywhere. It's not established in anything. Yeah. Because it isn't established in anything, yeah, there is no nama-rupa, which then comes into association with that consciousness. And when that is the case, and this is kind of the radical thing about the Buddha's teachings, when that is the case, instead of consciousness kind of continuing on its own without nama-rupa, because it isn't established anywhere, which is what you will see in certain other teachings perhaps, according to Buddhism, when it isn't established anything, it has to stop instead. It comes to an end right there and cannot go beyond. And this is kind of the radical thing. Whoa, it stops. And of course, when consciousness stops like that, it doesn't establish itself in any future realm, then all the rest of the links of dependent arising also have to stop as a consequence. No nama-rupa, right? Because no consciousness to establish in any realm. Because no nama-rupa, no salayatana, no sense bases, no contact, no feelings. Because there's no feeling, no craving, etc. And the whole thing kind of runs out. And there's nothing happening as a consequence of that. The whole thing then ceases as a consequence of the ending of avidya itself. So that is, in brief, what is happening there. Another way to also understand the cessation mode of dependent arising is to look at it through the link between Vedana and Tanha, feeling and craving, right? So that was like looking at the very beginning of the dependent arising. You can also look it at in the middle. And if you look at the middle, of course, what happens is that tanha ceases as a consequence of seeing things as they actually are. You understand that there is no happiness to be found there. So the craving for all of that stops. So now you still feel, but there is no craving here. You're no longer delighting in those things. You're no longer rejecting those things. You kind of just allow them to be, right? You allow things to be here. Because there's no craving. There is no taking up of things. You're not attached to anything anymore. You're not attached to theories, to ideas. You're not attached to worldly phenomena. Because you don't crave. You don't want to own anything here. As it says in one of the suttas, one of the characteristics of the arahat, that he or she is unable to store things as a person previously did in lay life. In other words, you can't really become owner of things anymore, right? You're no longer interested in all that. So because of that, because you're not the owner of anything, because you don't take things up, you don't exist anymore at any particular level. All of that, your mind is no longer interested in those things. Your mind doesn't roam around thinking about, your attachments and your desires about your relatives or whatever it is. It's just peaceful, because all of that is kind of gone. All of that is not interesting anymore. And then because, as I said before, the mind isn't at a certain level, no jati is possible. No jati, no birth, then no old age and death can happen as a consequence. So two ways of looking at the dependent arising formula. So that is the formula in brief. And I hope you are still with me to some extent at least. I will be going through this in much more depth over the next few days because I don't know, personally I find it quite interesting and quite useful in the practice how to actually use these things. So hopefully we'll get even more clarity about these things as we go along. I'm going to stop there because the hour is almost up. As always, there will be a Q&A session in the evening. You're more than welcome to ask questions. Please write them down on the piece of paper. If we have too much verbal communication or concern, it's going to be too kind of too noisy perhaps or whatever. So if you can write down, that would be great. And if I don't answer your questions properly, you're always welcome, of course, to write another question on the following day or whatever, so that we can sort things out to whatever extent that's possible. So, okay, very good. So that's all for now. And I'll see you again this evening at 7 o'clock this evening. Okay.